I want to thank Jeremy for leading the songs before the lesson tonight. I think it fits perfectly with our topic. Let me get all this stuff set here. Wonderfully Made. If you would, go ahead and open up to Psalm 139. I'm going to read just a couple of verses there, and then we'll get started. Psalm 139, verse 13, beginning. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb, and I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. Before we get started, I'm going to hedge a little bit. We are going to be covering a lot of information. And just for the sake of time, this is going to be from a 30,000 foot view with everything. And we could go deeper into certain aspects, and you may have said, well, he really overlooked that with a really good place to connect a dot there. I get it. I feel the same way. So you may feel that way, but secondly, also, I'm not an expert in biology or chemistry. If I say something wrong or mix up a term, have a little bit of grace. It's a lot to cover. I may look up at some of our nursing professionals and doctors in the room just to get a nod of affirmation that the words I'm using are correct or concepts are correct. All that being said, what we're going to talk about tonight, it's something that's fascinated me since I was a kid. I wanted to become a biologist when I was in high school, but I got into chemistry, and then I said, yeah, no, not doing that. That's way too complicated. So this is a topic that I find a lot of interest in and have spent some time in, and just science and nature just fascinates me. So the reason I wanted to talk about this topic is twofold. First, we're going to be going through an evidences class with the high school kids this next trimester. And this is kind of a drop in the bucket of things we're going to be talking about from a biblical perspective. How do we recognize God in creation and the evidences that support that? And we're going to be doing that with Norm and I are going to be co-teaching that class. And we've taught about that in the past. We're going to be getting into a little bit more complex discussions than we have before. So I'm really excited about that. But also, again, I'm just very interested in this topic. And I hope that you can hopefully take away something profound throughout all of this. So the things we're going to be covering tonight, in short, is a brief review of evolution and Darwinism, and like how do we come to some of these conclusions out in the world? What are we going to see? Some basics about cells and chromosomes and atoms and things along those very microscopic lines. The immense complexity of DNA and what that even is and how it is involved in all living things. And then we're going to finish with this concept of irreducible complexity. It's a term that was coined a couple of decades ago, and we'll talk about that some more. Before we get into the lesson again, one thing that I have come to grips with in regards to this topic is no matter what evidence we may bring to an evolutionist, someone that is bent on disbelieving in God and bent on seeing an evolutionary process, there's nothing that we can show them that's going to change their mind most of the time. That's just how they are going to see things. We're all looking at the same evidence. We don't have something special that evolutionists don't have, and they don't have something special that we don't have. We're looking at the same information, and we're coming to vastly different conclusions. So I've given up on the hope that there's something out there that if I could just find this one thing or explain it better, it would end up converting somebody from evolution over to creation and seeing God. So while we're going to talk about evolution and how to kind of combat some of those things, that's not the purpose of this lesson. We will talk about that, and we're not going to gloss over those things. But the purpose of this lesson is for us to see that we are wonderfully made. Otherwise, I would have titled it How to Debate an Evolutionist, and that's beyond the scope of this. So, for the benefit of you and I to see God's creation in his handiwork and appreciate that more fully, I hope we can take some things away from this as we go through our time tonight. So, like I said, we have a lot to cover, so let's get started. So let's talk about Charles Darwin and evolution. So Charles Darwin is the pioneer of what we understand as being evolution today. So he had this trip in 1835, I believe it was, on the ship called the Beagle. And he went around the Galapagos Islands as a botanist, and he saw these finches. And he made some conclusions about these finches and the differences between them, and this idea of small changes over time can lead to vastly different changes and even complete different species in the future. And so this tree of life idea came from that you trace all of these organic life forms back to some beginning point back billions of years ago. And it was hypothesized that this all happened through natural selection. I'm going to talk about all these things, but just to give you a cliff notes here. So here's a diagram of these finches, these Galapagos Island finches. And you can see they've got different sized beaks, and some of them are larger, and they have different colored feathers, and the eyes are a little bit different shaped as well. And the idea is as you study these finches more, the ones that have these really narrow beaks, these smaller beaks, are really good at getting in small places and eating insects. They're not so good at getting nuts or breaking into bark. But these guys down here, these gigantic beaks, they're not so good at finding these small insects on the ground or getting into, you know, cracks in trees. They're specialized in breaking nuts and opening up, you know, stuff on the ground and cracking stuff open. That's their primary food source. So the idea is these small micro changes among these finches have developed that these finches don't even crossbreed anymore. They're uniquely identifiable. And so it's from this idea that these small changes, given enough time, one of these will eventually become an eagle, basically is what that idea comes to, right? So that's the idea of natural selection and Darwin and how he theorized about this process. So natural selection is, from National Geographic, pulled this from their website, is the process through which populations of living organisms adapt and change, and individuals in a population are naturally variable, meaning that they are all different in some ways. I mean, look at the room around you. We all have different colored hair and eyes, and our arms are different lengths, and I'm tall and my wife is short, and we have variation, right? We get that. This variation means that some individuals have traits better suited to environment than others. I am not a good basketball player. I may be tall, but I'm not that tall, and I'm not super athletically inclined. The idea is that eventually you see these traits carry on, and people are better at certain things, or these animals are better at certain things. You've got this insect-eating finch and the one that's focused on nuts. We got the idea. Natural selection. So another part of this is variation, competition, adaptation, and then selection. Am I supposed to have a clip mic, David? I'm sorry. I keep turning around, and I don't know if you can hear me or not. I'll just grab this. So you have this idea, okay, we go out in the world, we see different colored butterflies, and they have different colored offspring that, you know, live on trees. And then the brown ones are a little bit more likely to survive because they blend in with the tree. They don't get eaten by the hungry birds than the bright yellow one up there. That's the idea. So the idea is this trait that is going to make these caterpillars brown becomes more common, and then we see, again, the species adaptation. It's the survival of the fittest. That's the term that we often associate with evolution, right? The same theory, the same concept goes for giraffes, is at some point in the past, some horse-like creature eventually was born with an unusually long neck, right? The Michael Jordan of the horse world, right? He can dunk on anything, or maybe Shaquille O'Neal, that'd be a better size difference, right? And so the idea is that these other animals that couldn't reach these other food sources, they couldn't make it because the tall giraffes were just getting all the goods. It's a funny fact, this is a side point, most giraffes don't actually eat like that. They eat horizontally in front of them, for what that's worth. But that's the idea. They can reach food sources, they survive, and then, oh no, our poor little short giraffes, they don't make it because they can't get the food sources. That's the idea, this natural selection again. So let's talk about evolution. Let's go back. Roughly 4 billion years ago, somewhere around in here. And we're going to skip over the Big Bang. I'm just going to give them that at this point, right? No, this is not the point of that topic. So we're just going to assume, we're not going to argue that point. We're just going to come to this point here where they say a single-celled life begins to exist. Here we are. And then roughly, what is that, 3 billion years later, now we start to see actual a change over time from this Big Bang and from this single-celled organism that came on the scene 3.5 billion years ago. And we'll talk briefly about how this idea alone is incredibly complex once you understand what is required for even the simplest form of life to even exist, these single-celled organisms. Just to get that, we'll get there. So roughly 3 billion years later, we see all of this. Okay, so this is a span of time. So here we have this single-celled organism, again, 35 billion years ago. And then time marches on in both directions, and then we see this complexity, this tree of life happening. And then way over here, this is us. And that's recent day. And this is 65 million years right here, that little ditch, okay? So the idea is from this one single cell, you eventually get to algae and bacteria and sharks and fish and amphibians and crocodiles and turtles and birds and finches and you and I and dogs and cats and elephants, right? And so roughly 65 million years ago, this bit of time right here, all mammals, they're assumed to have a single ancestor. And I don't just mean like we have a single ancestor, but I mean like you and me and dolphins and elephants and all of that have a shared ancestor, right? And that's the idea. That's what's being argued here. Everything that's warm-blooded. But it's very interesting that it's very hard to explain how dolphins and platypuses fit into that mammalian structure because, you know, everything on this side of this list that they put on here is classified as mammals. They all have fur. They all breathe air. They live on land. They give birth to live young. They feed their, you know, their newborns with milk. They don't come from an egg, right? Those are the requirements to be over on this side of the pier, of the tree. But dolphins and killer whales, they do all that in the water. The argument is that mammals came from some animal in the water, and eventually they learned how to ditch their lungs and breathe air, and they stopped using eggs to give birth to their young, and they had live young, and then eventually they started producing milk so the babies didn't die. All this stuff took place, and then eventually the dolphin said, ah, this land stuff's not for me. I'm going to go back in the water. It doesn't fit that narrative, and that's the argument, is that dolphins, well, they had some reason to be back in the oceans, and so there they go, giving birth to live young, being warm-blooded, breathing air, and giving milk to their babies in the water. I don't know how that fits. Platypuses. If a platypus was not alive today and we found a fossil of this thing, talk about a missing link. So platypuses are mammals. They end up over here, right? And they, as you probably can see, they have fur. They have a bill like a duck. Over here in the bird area. So where do we put this thing? It's got claws like an otter. It has bills and fin and flippers like a duck. It has a tail like a beaver. It lays eggs, and then it feeds its babies with milk. It doesn't fit anywhere. So if you think about that, it's like, well, this is the missing link. But here it is, being as incredible and weird as ever. Platypuses are awesome. For that fact alone, I love them. They should be a mascot for the church or something. I don't know. So that's evolutionary history from a 30,000 foot view. This is where we all came from. So from a single cell back here, mutations, small adaptations, big beaks, small birds, big birds, elephants. There we go. So this idea of microevolution or small changes over time, I agree with that. We see that in creation. There's no argument there. I think we would all agree with evolutionists that these small changes that we see with the finches and with these fruit flies, that happens, right? We see variation. Again, look at the room around you. We're not all, you know, carbon copies of each other. And we look at your kids, like they look a lot like you, right? Genetics pass on. There's small changes, and we get that idea. We see that, and again, fruit flies, dogs, apples, people, birds. And we understand this through what's called selective breeding. So it's not just random chance happening out in nature, like you see this with dogs. As you see, well, we want to get certain traits. We want the bulldog's feet to be wider. We want their skin to be a little bit softer and flappier. And so over time, what they used to be 100-some years ago and where they are now look a little bit different. Like you can see there's some selective changes that have happened over time. Where do you think Honeycrisp apples came from? Like that was somebody going, you know what? This particular strand of apples tastes great. And it crunches like a chip and it's incredible. I don't know if y'all have not had a Honeycrisp apple or not, but they are delicious. But I tell you what, guess what? We look back at all three of those things or anything else in nature. Guess what? They're still apples. They're still dogs. They're still people. They're still fruit flies. I'm not arguing there's changes between, but we're not seeing this interspecies jump that evolution requires to happen. But even after all that, so let's talk about what the Bible says about variation and creation. Go ahead and turn to Genesis chapter 1, and we're going to read a chunk there together. Starting in verse 11, I'm going to read through this quickly again, just because we've got a lot more to go, and I know the clock's ticking. Genesis 1, verse 11. And God said, "Let the earth sprout forth vegetation and plants, yielding seed and fruits, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which their seed, each according to its kind, and on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation and plants, yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which it is their seed according to its kind. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and morning the third day." And then somewhere in the middle of the next couple of verses, you know, he just makes all of the things we see in the sky. Stars, moon, sun, just that little bit. Okay, we're going to skip over that amazing thing. Go on to verse 20. "And let the water swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse in the heavens. And so God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, in which the water swarms according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And he said, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters of the sea, and let the birds multiply on the earth.' And there was evening and morning, and there was the fifth day. And then God said," verse 24, "'let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kinds.' And it was so." And so we have this idea of this reproduction and growth of God's creation according to its kind. Like we see this reproduction that's being proclaimed by God to happen. This is what's supposed to happen according to God's word. So rather than a tree of life stemming from some single cell 35 billion years ago, what we see in Scripture is this more of an orchard of life, is that we have God's creatures, plants and animals and bugs and creeping things and things in the sea and things that swim and things that fly and people, and we are to reproduce according to our kinds. So we see that there's plenty of room in God's creation for variety, but it's very specific as to the limits of that variety. So that brings us to Darwin's black box. Many scholars, or you know, theological scholars, have said that if Darwin only understood or could see into the cells of living organisms and to understand DNA and genetics, he would have never even have carried on with the idea of this natural selection process in this 35 billion year old timeline. It was gargantuan mathematically. The complexity makes it impossible. But before we talk about DNA, this double helix, beautiful strand that we're looking at right here, let's talk about some basics. Basics in big quotes, because these are incredible things. So, First, we have, you know, atoms and molecules and compounds. This is just the basic building blocks of matter. Anything you can touch, feel, see, put your hand on, smell, comes from this stuff, right? And so we all know that from school. It's a water molecule or a compound. We've got oxygen and two hydrogens, and they bond together. And now what was a gas is something you can drink and something your body needs frequently, or you're going to die. So this is a very important molecule. So remember back the periodic table of elements. Last time I checked, it's about 118 different elements, I believe. And those are atoms, like oxygen and hydrogen, in their most basic forms. And you can take these things like Lego bricks, more or less. Again, I'm simplifying things drastically here, but bear with me. Keep running. You can take these molecules like Lego bricks, build them together into almost anything, right? The levels of uniqueness and complexity of molecular structures theoretically are infinite. Like, there, you can almost do anything. Like, you've got two water molecules together, well, let's just put two more together. You got a carbon link, put another carbon link. The idea is you can continue to add on to these chains to make, you know, a desk or metal, right? You get the idea. Okay, moving on. So atoms, raw materials for matter. Then we've got chromosomes, right? Heard about those before in biology somewhere in our distant past, right? And that is what makes up us. That's DNA and genetics. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. Proteins. That's this ribbon-looking thing. And we're going to talk about that more in a minute as well. But proteins are macromolecules. They're gigantic combinations of molecules to build a structure. Okay? They're found in almost every single biological process that exists. Like, if you're breathing, you thank proteins for that. If your muscle can move, you're thanking proteins for that. If you're able to see, you're thanking proteins for that. Okay? So proteins can contain tens of thousands of atoms. You get basic building blocks, build together, you get proteins. Proteins do things. They're these gigantic molecules, still microscopic. You know, even the largest of proteins are still only nanometers big, which is, well, it's really small, okay? And proteins are made up of what's called amino acid chains, all right? You feel like you're back in school yet? So we'll talk more about those in a minute. And what these chains do and their function is based on the order they're put in, kind of like how, you know, the order you put together certain parts of a computer is how it's going to function. Same thing with proteins. You put these molecules in the right order, you get a new protein. So again, in reality, they're just very, very complex micro machines that do work inside of every organism. We'll talk about those more in a second. They're very specialized most of the time. They help digest food. They carry nutrients around your body, help your muscles move. They build structures in your body, like your nails and your hair. They help your blood clot, and that's what brings oxygen from your lungs into your blood and then elsewhere throughout your body. All of that happens because of proteins. Cells, that's the other part of this equation. And again, if you remember anything from high school biology, you had to memorize what all of these little things are, and you had to scribble them out on a piece of paper if you were going to pass your test. Let me tell you, if you forgot those things, we're going to remind you. Well, just one of them, really. But very useful information. They're so helpful when you're doing a load of laundry or taxes. You want to make sure you know how to label those things, kids. Don't forget it. So you have skin, you have cells. So your body is comprised of cells. You've got stem cells, blood cells, skin cells. You've got fat cells and cancer cells, or the nasty ones. You've got nerve cells in your brain. So your body is comprised of all of these things. And they're what make you you, and what make a plant, and what makes a dog is the composition of its cells and the DNA inside of it. It's what makes sure you have two eyes and two hands and 10 toes and 2 feet and lungs and a heart, and all of those things come from your cells. So how does that work? Well, how do all these things work together? We talked about that a second ago, this Darwin's black box of DNA. Okay, so that stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. Say that 10 times fast. So this is a cell. Again, we talked about that a second ago. And if the only thing I can really remember is the nucleus. I don't know about any of y'all, but if I said, "What can you label something on this cell?" It's probably just the nucleus right there. Okay? And inside the nucleus of the cell, the only thing it's supposed to do is hold these things called chromosomes. Talked about those a second ago, too. So all a chromosome is, and you've got about 40 plus of these, right? Is tightly wound strands of DNA, okay? So this is something we recognize. And this one little section of this strand of DNA is called a gene. And what a gene does is give instructions to make a protein, like how to make blood for you so you don't die. That's pretty useful. I want my genes to do that. Not these genes, but those genes. Okay. So that's what DNA does. DNA is tightly wound up. You get a chromosome. There's millions and millions of strands of DNA inside of that chromosome. You've got a bunch of those inside of every single one of the nucleuses in your cell. So hopefully here. Okay, I'm going to fly through this part. Every strand of DNA is composed of only four parts, if you will. Okay? And again, they're molecules. It's a structure of atoms. Adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine. It's the only four parts that make up your DNA. And they're just jumbled in together in what seems to be a random fashion. Kind of like zeros and ones in the binary code of a computer. Right? This is the instructions for how to make you, you. This is what keeps you from having two heads or five hands or an arm sticking out of your chest. Your DNA is what regulates all of this. Okay? So here's one more thing that's very important to get this idea across. And again, I hope your brain's spinning already, because this is the level of complexity that evolutionists are saying just happened. It just happened. Random chance. Shake it up in a jar. You get a bird eventually. This is the process that's required to make simple things work. Okay? Lock arms. We're going to keep running. Here we go. This is called a ribosome. Okay? All a ribosome does is take information from your strands of DNA to make a protein. It's a protein factory. Right? Your DNA has the instructions. Here's how you make this protein for your blood. And then it goes out to a ribosome, and the ribosome goes, okay, we're going to make that protein. And it just assembles it together, and now you have hemoglobin. We'll talk about that in a second. But that's what a ribosome does. So if this works, I don't know, David, if you can, if I need to click or you need to click, this is going to be a short video that's going to talk about how this works. Fantastic. All right, so here we go. We've got a cell. Okay, so we're just going to follow the process of going from this strain of DNA to a protein, which is, again, is this machine to help your body do stuff. Okay? We're on a time thing here, buddy. Let's go. All right. Okay, so here we go. We got a nucleus that's in the middle of our cell. And you go inside, and again, there eventually we get into a chromosome, right? That's that tightly wound string of DNA, your instructions for you. And you peel off a little bit of that. We're going to ignore these things, these histones. Those are important, but not for tonight. And eventually you get this DNA strand. Again, there's all your chains, these bonds, cytosine and thymine, guanine. And then you have this section right here that's going to be coded or encoded off your DNA. So this little guy right here, this polymerase, comes through, and it basically unzips your DNA for a second. Zoop! And then takes all of these other molecular structures that are perfectly matched to only match in those one things. Notice the A's go to the T's, the U's go to the A's, C's go to the G's, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this polymerase basically creates this little strand off of your DNA. And this is now called a messenger RNA or an mRNA. And it's basically just there to take the instructions to those ribosomes. So it goes, okay, here's the instructions in your DNA. We're going to make a couple edits because of what we're trying to build. And now we're going to take this train of instructions. We're going to zoom it through, take it out of your nucleus. And again, this is still happening in your cell. Like, this is ridiculous. You guys get that, right? This is unbelievably incredible. Okay, so this flies out and it goes through the cytoplasm in your cell. And then it goes through this ribosome. Remember, this that protein factory. And then so the ribosome goes, okay, here's the instructions. Let's get to work. And so what it starts to do is connect these amino acids with these tRNA or transfer RNA. And you notice there's a little key there next to it, okay? And hey, look at that. We've seen those letters before. Those tRNA structures that have a protein or an amino acid attached go specifically into these triplets. They're called triplets, okay? So this particular amino acid only connects to this particular section on the tRNA, which goes onto the mRNA, which came from your DNA. to build this little worm-looking thing. Okay? This is the beginnings of a protein. Remember, ribosomes are just protein factories. You're making a protein. You're doing something useful for your body. Okay? Now, it's a molecular structure. It's just full of atoms. Talked about those. And because of the amino acids that comprise it, it causes it to take a certain shape. Okay? Just like how metal, you can form it to make a hammer or a saw or a chisel, and they both do different things. So it's all still metal, but the way you form it can do certain things that are special. So that's what DNA and ribosomes and tRNA does. Okay. Stay with me. Can I get a nod from everyone? Okay, great, sweet. There we go. So I talked about this little thing called hemoglobin. We've heard that before in biology, maybe. It has to do with our blood, right? And so what hemoglobin does, this is just a protein. So a section of your DNA says, hey, we need more blood. Maybe you gave blood recently and your body's going, we need to pump this stuff up. So it's like, okay, we're going to start working on blood cells. So your DNA says, okay, we need more hemoglobin. Does all that stuff through the tRNA, mRNA. Man, there's a lot of tongue twisters in this one. And eventually you get to this, right? So it kicks out this protein. And what hemoglobin proteins are very good at, wouldn't you know it, holding oxygen. They're like oxygen sponges. And that's exactly what we need from our blood, because our blood goes into our lungs, absorbs oxygen, goes through your body, and helps your other cells breathe. It's pretty cool, right? So that's what that does. I need to catch up on my notes. I've been talking for a minute. I'm not sure where I'm at. Hemoglobin, yeah, okay. Okay, I'm going to pause for a second. It's important to mention here that in every living thing, DNA is the instructions to build that thing. That's why dolphins don't have flowers on their backs, and that's why pigs don't have wings, and that's why apples don't have brains. The instructions aren't there to make those things. The instructions are there to make a dolphin, and the instructions are there to make an apple or a fruit, right? So how does the evolutionist get around this issue of there's no information inside of this apple to build it a brain? What do you do? So here's how the evolutionists get around this issue. So the first we talked about already is these micro changes. You have small changes, and eventually you have an apple that tastes more like a pear, that tastes more like a nut, that all of a sudden can become, you know, who knows what, that's not a plant. That's the idea. Micro changes over billions of years, given enough time, you have those changes. So that's one of their answers to that. Eventually, it gives birth to a whole different animal, something completely different. Didn't even have the previous one in common. That's not even fair, because we're just combining a couple of things that already exist. But I believe the main argument to that is this idea of fruit flies. And here's why, okay? In order for humans to have one generational genetic cycle, you know, from birth to maturity to another birth and maturity, is about 20 years or so on average, maybe a little more, a little less. But it's about 20 years for one generation to take place for humans, for genetic information to change, okay? Fruit flies, we can go through about 25 generations a year. So we're able to see genetic changes happening very, 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 very quickly, over and over and over and over and over again, and not even just random chance. Like, we're forcefully tweaking what fruit flies are getting with other fruit flies to get certain traits to happen. Like, we're almost trying to force evolution with fruit flies. And we can do this 25 generations a year. You know when these studies started? 1901. This has been going on for 100 years. And if they're averaging 20 generations, like, think about that. Think of how many iterations of these small changes could have been made between then and now. They're still fruit flies. I don't know how you get past that. Maybe you add another billion years onto these cycles. Okay. But I feel like, again, with the level of intention that's been given to fruit flies and their genetic changes, surely we would have seen something that didn't look like a fruit fly. But guess what? Always looks like a fruit fly. So the other answer to this problem of, okay, so there's a lot of complexity. Genetics are only coded to build that thing. What do you do? Well, that's mutations, right? Genetics gone wrong. it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. That's why you have things that have a hoof coming out of its neck or an extra foot. You may have seen those snakes or turtles that have like two heads coming out. That's a genetic mutation. That's not supposed to happen, right? Most of the time with genetic mutations, it's deadly. Like, they don't even survive. Like, usually when you have genes mutate that badly, you just die. Or if you do survive, life's not that great, and you end up not really carrying your genes on. And that's just assuming that this mutation was actually even useful. Most of the time, it's not. As a matter of fact, all the time, it's not. I don't know about you. I don't want an arm coming up my chest. So that's mutations. So again, I throw that to the side as well. Some mutations in, you know, humans is cancer, sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, just to name a few. You know, those are mutations in your genes. Like what sickle cell anemia is your blood cells don't form right, and they can't hold hemoglobin right, and therefore they can't transmit oxygen around your body right. Like, that's a problem, all right? So those types of things are usually, those mutations are not helpful. They don't want to progress. So why am I talking about all this stuff and giving a painful crash course on biology and chemistry? Why have I brought you guys back to school for the last, you know, 30 minutes? If somebody dropped off a package of well-organized planks and wood and screws and a hammer and maybe some instructions to go along with it, and they put it on the doorstep and they said, yeah, the paper mill down the road just blew up, and this just kind of popped out. I knew that you like building stuff. You might want to, you know, have a whack at it. They'd be laughed at. That's crazy that something that is random as an explosion could cause this to become organized and useful, and for instructions to appear out of nowhere that goes along with the material that I have. Random chances compounded over millions and millions of years with just raw material, more or less shaken in a jar, eventually given enough time, could produce a package-labeled box that says IKEA, ready for me to build a cabinet, is as crazy as it sounds. To take it a step further, it should build itself, because that's what's happening in genetics. Right? It is operating on its own. Like, we should not have to build IKEA furniture. That's what I'm getting at. To think about the construction at Broadmoor, we've been seeing, right? We didn't show up to the building one day and go, I guess that rainstorm threw some bricks into place. Like, that's just not how the world works. Nobody thinks that way. But when we look at stuff as complex as this, we go, yep, that just happened. I can't help but my jaw dropping, even from trying to take a skeptical view. Like, it boggles my mind. I don't know how you get around that. So that's why I'm talking to you about all this, the immense complexity of DNA to be done correctly, in order, from the start, for even the most basic of functions to exist, is literally astronomical. It is literally astronomical. And to think that it happened at random, even once, much less again and again and again and again, I find it confounding. I'll leave that to you if I haven't made a case to make you at least go, wow, that's crazy. To see the level of diversity that we have in the world, when there's design, there is a designer. When there's a book of instructions, there's a writer or a creator. When there is a watch, there's a watchmaker. That's the, you know, argument often made in conjunction with these thoughts. You know, you are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 104:24, how many are your works, Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. We can stop right there. But real quick, if you can bear with me, for 10 more minutes, I will run through this and hopefully we'll wrap it up with a nice little bow. This is one of the topics we are going to be talking about in the class this next trimester specifically, which is that of irreducible complexity. So this was a coin from a gentleman named Michael Behe, and he wrote this book called Darwin's Black Box. And he was the one who said, okay, if you really could dive into what a cell looked like and look at DNA, it would throw that idea out the window. So he came up with this idea of irreducible complexity on a bacterial flagellum, which is this little mousy tail-looking thing. This is called a flagellum, okay? And it's basically a propeller and a motor that helps the cell move through liquid. That's what it does, okay? It consists of a motor and stator and clamps and a propeller and all of the parts that you would kind of expect to find on an outboard motor on a boat, right? That's what makes the flagellum spin and move. This tail whips around. That tail can spin from 20,000 to 100,000 revolutions a minute. To put that in perspective, the drive shaft in your car can spin around 2,000 to maybe 6,000 if you're booking it. An F1 car, like a Formula One race car, 15,000 RPMs and above, it'll just shred itself to bits. 20,000 on the low side, this thing will be spinning. Just happened. So there's all these parts. And what this means by irreducible complexity is if you remove any one of these components, the whole thing is useless, doesn't do anything. You get rid of the propeller part, this corkscrew at the back, won't move. It's just a motor with no propeller. Try going out in a boat with no propeller. You're going to get stuck if you can even get out there. You need a paddle. You got these little things, these stators. Like that's what sends the electrons through the motor from the outside of the membrane into the cell to actually cause rotation to happen. You get rid of that, you just have a propeller with no gas. Won't do anything. You get rid of these little guys, it won't hold on to the cell wall and it'll just spin wildly off. Cell won't go anywhere. So the idea is you take any piece of this very complex system away, nothing works. It's like a mousetrap. You have four parts to it mostly. You get rid of one of them, you can't catch a mouse. You get rid of the spring, won't snap. You get rid of the latch, you can't hold the spring down. You get rid of the board, you just have a hunk of metal. Irreducible complexity is what this is. And so what Behe came to talk about was, this can't happen from evolution, because the idea of evolution is you're carrying on traits. You have something that works well, and you add to it. You have something else that works well with that, and you add to that. You have something else that works well with these two components, and those go together, and now you have a new system. With this, all of these pieces on their own do nothing useful. So the idea is for this to have evolved over time, the cell, this simple life form, would have had to have been carrying pieces of equipment with it for millions of years, doing nothing. Just sitting there, waiting, hopefully, that if I can just get this one more component figured out right, we're going to move and we're going to finally catch dinner. That's the idea. This idea of irreversible complexity. Romans 1, verse 20. For since the creation of the world, God's inevitable qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. We haven't even touched on this stuff yet. When there is evidence of a design, there is a designer. It's not only reasonable to believe in a designer, it's necessary. And the one who designed and created all of these things made himself known to us. Not only in creation, but also through sending his son as a witness into the world. John 1 said, and following verses talk about this quite directly. Jesus was the Word, and he was God, and with God in the beginning, and with him everything was made. Jesus is the light of the world and who came into the world, but the world and his people didn't know him. And they rejected him and they did not receive him. But to those who did receive him were granted the right to become children of God. The one who made all this wants you to be his kid. It's a pretty good deal. But we want to extend an opportunity to accept that. Now again, this lesson wasn't designed to teach the gospel of Jesus, or to talk about his death or resurrection or the opportunity for your sins to be forgiven. But that's exactly what the disciples did in Acts chapter 2 when day of Pentecost came. And they were pricked in their hearts and they realized what they had done. They had killed the Son of God. And they said, what do we do to be saved? What must we do? And he said, to repent and to be baptized for the remission of your sins. And we give that same opportunity now. If there's any way we can help you tonight, please come forward as we stand and we sing together.